You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, first broadcast on the 29th of December 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to episode 234 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. This is a very special Christmas edition of the show. We'll have a notably holiday theme.
We'll be catching up with comedian Dom Jolly, who's looking at the weird and sometimes wonderful habits of people during Christmas.
Also, to get us in the festive spirit, we'll be sitting down with Simon Gamble, the man behind the startup gin brand that's just gotten the backing of one of the most famous stores here in the UK.
And they're the people behind some of the biggest parties around the world. We'll be talking Christmas events with Andrea Sterling from B&H Group.
Plenty to entertain us, Andrea, on this Christmas edition of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. And there we have it. We're here. We've come over the final. We've run down the final furlong. We're struggling.
You can't even say
we're
struggling. Go over it.
Well, we've been out for lunch, haven't we?
Yes, we've been out for lunch. This is the very. Well, we're kind of almost at the end of the year.
Yeah.
And this show is going to have one badly behaved comedian.
It is.
It's going to have a lot of gin.
Yeah.
And it's going to have a torch garden.
So can you guarantee those three things? Is that the three things you're going to guarantee our listeners so that they don't tune out in the next 5 minutes?
If they hear the thwack of leather near you, Robert Bound. What was that laugh?
That was small laugh. Smaller laugh.
That was a laugh.
My torture laugh.
Okay. I think it's going to be a hold on to your hats show.
Hold on to your headphones.
Hold on to your headphones because you can't really have a hat with headphones as well.
I was going to have that yesterday. I came in. I had the flat cap on, but it doesn't work with a headphone. It's ridiculous.
it's ridiculous.
You look like someone that should be essentially giving out the racing tips. You know what I mean? It's not really. Never the twain shall meet. Never shall a flat cap. And a headphone meet. Tech and tweed, Andrew. Doesn't meet. Doesn't work.
Now, because this is a special Christmas show, we're not having Ted Woods for the news review.
No.
He's gone to bully his
builders, hasn't he?
He's gone to Walthamstow, where he's just moved to.
Bullying the builders sounds like a euphemism for something, doesn't it? Yeah. I'm going home to bully the builder.
Okay. Let's just say this is pre-gin. Let's hold on, because coming up next is Mr. Dom Jolly.
And welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. On today's special holiday edition of the programme, we're celebrating all things Christmas, and our next guest is back in the headlines for putting a spotlight on our weird and wonderful habits around this time of year.
Comedian Dom Jolly first came to fame here in the United Kingdom for his television show Trigger Happy TV, a hidden camera show that was subsequently sold to over 70 countries. But now Dom has teamed up with Microsoft for a series of new videos which highlight how we behave during the holidays. Dom joins us in the studio now. Do they highlight how we behave during the holidays?
He's making a very subtle face, wasn't he?
Firstly, I love your name. Bounds and Tuck sounds like a sort of pet food.
It's like a medieval butcher.
Second, there was a subtle reference to we got a holiday man. Basically, it doesn't work very hard.
Yeah. Bounds
used to be my boss ages ago.
I know.
Look what happened to me.
I used to send in my column and he used to go, oh my God, this is awful. And then send me a thing going, it's great, really good, really good.
We did have a couple of nice lunches, though.
Yes, we did.
I took you to Locanda Locatelli.
You did, yeah.
But they don't do that anymore in newspapers.
I think that was the last time I got any money from the Independent.
They used to pay you in luncheon.
I wish. They pay me nothing. I could literally, I think, hand deliver my column to more people than read the Independent on Sunday. But I think having a column on the Independent is like owning the Independent. You don't, you know, it's not going to make you any money, but it's just something that's nice to have after
a bit of leverage.
Rather than squirrel impersonator. Something.
Now look, you've made these videos.
I'm not there anymore. You can say what you want.
You're the only
person I've ever met who's left the Independent and hasn't had some deal where they have to have a column for 30 years afterwards, which is why Janet Street Porter is still employed.
I was offered. I said no.
So a contra column.
I want to talk about what you've done. You've done a video about selfies.
I have. Basically,
you've made it sound rudder than it is.
Yeah, I know. A selfie does sound a bit.
Selfie is weird. I genuinely heard that word 4 months ago, and I realised that there had been no word for what I'd been doing for ages, taking pictures of myself. And then literally the day afterwards, you can't hear anything but that word, and it's been made word of the year, whatever. But it's a bit rubbish, really.
Well, I saw in the Telegraph that Prince Charles had it wasn't really a selfie.
Has he done one?
No, a young boy did a selfie with Prince Charles looming over his shoulder.
See, that's an unintentional photo bomb on the selfie.
Yes.
I think for a selfie, you have to have, everyone has to be acquiescing.
Yes.
And then, of course, as I've been doing with these Bing things, fubbing. Do you know about fubbing?
Yeah, well, I did. So we watched the video in preparation for this interview.
Did you know that before?
No, I didn't know what that was.
Because I didn't know the word, but it's a brilliant word, and it's true. I use that all the time. I'm sort of standing there. Someone comes up to me, I think, oh, my God, he's going to be a loony. Mm. So I sort of pretend to be deeply engrossed in my phone.
And fubbing is a portmanteau word, and it means... It means
snubbing with a phone.
A phone
snub. It's actually quite good, yeah.
Yeah, it's a good one.
I love the fact that you've made a career out of kind of being the weird person next to other people, and then you're scared about people coming up to you in case they're a bit odd.
Well, it's just, you know, the only people come up to me, there's three types. They either come up to me and shout hello really loudly.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I still haven't sort of thought of a decent answer. You just go hello. Or it's independent readers who are then really angry because I'm probably right wing for them, whatever. And then there's just weird people that are drunk and I can't remember. But no, I do fub a lot. It's terrible. And also, if you're sitting on your own and you're in any way famous, even on my tiny level, people just do look and go, what a loser. Look, he's sitting on his own. And they constantly expect you to be in some champagne reception.
Yeah,
I quite
right.
like sitting on my own.
You can't just be sort of getting a coffee from Pret and being a normal human
being. Well, I think
it's
a bit like being... My wife, like, would never go on her own to a restaurant. She sort of sees it as a, I don't know, some sort of failure thing. I can't think of anything I like better than go to the restaurant, have a meal, read a book. But you can see people going, oh, my God, what a loser. Why is he not having a power lunch?
I'm having a power lunch, a power of one.
This is for business people, right?
Yeah, exactly. So where do fubbing and these other brand new sort of portmanteau words come from? Where do they sit?
Yeah. What do you mean by portmanteau?
I mean, it's
carrier coat.
I think it's two words made of two halves of other words.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah. So slang words. Well, I was basically Bing approached me because they've got a problem because everyone Googles.
Yeah.
It's become the Hoover.
Yeah.
You know, you don't even say let's look it up. You say Google, and they said, you know, we've got a really good search engine, but no one looks at it. And I have to say, I was a bit I wouldn't either.
Yeah.
And they had a brilliant little test where you do 10 random searches and they show Google and Bing, and genuinely 8 out of 10 the ones I chose was Bing. So I was quite excited by that. And they're obviously trying to get people to give Bing a go. So that's why I did these. And it was quite good fun. I love doing stuff with mobile phones. I could almost film a whole series on a mobile phone now. That's what's exciting.
I suppose it is a strange thing for you after obviously the trigger happy success to be incognito. Because obviously for this you've dyed your hair blonde and you look different on these videos, don't you?
I still.
But presumably people are like, what?
Do you know what's quite funny? On my last series, Full Britannia, I did full prosthetics. I was literally 3 hours in the morning and I thought, God, I feel so different. I had different coloured eyes and stuff.
Yeah.
And then when I look at the series, I'm like, actually I just look like me with a big nose. It is very weird. It is quite difficult. The thing is about being in England, everyone thought I stopped trigger because everyone recognised me. But I literally can look at a street and I can tell you the people that will know who I am.
Yeah.
They're a very clear demographic of about, they're exactly what you want advertisers, about 18 to 35. They're perfect.
Let's get him in. My favourite line from anything you've ever done, still my favourite thing is 2 tickets for Upper Circle.
I don't even know that one. Where's that?
I don't know what it is. I think you're dressed in a Union Jack hat and you're in Piccadilly Circus Station pretending that you're a Dutch tourist or something.
Oh, okay.
That's, 2 tickets
I've
for
never
Upper
been
Circle.
That. I love that.
No one knows about that one.
That's my only accent I can do, actually.
It's Saul and me constantly just say that to each other when we're drunk. I don't know why, where it came from. I know it came from Trigger Happy TV.
I love that.
But there we go. Tom Jolly is talking about fubbing. It's all about Bing. It's on, presumably, if you wanted to look them up, but you would Bing it, not Google it.
You would definitely Bing it, and you'll look at it on the internet. So if you're on a plane and your porn movie's finished early, then, you know, look
or
at
you
this.
Have.
Yeah, or you've finished early, yeah.
Now, tell me, the selfie thing also obviously came in the news because of Mr. Obama and the Danish Prime Minister and, our own Prime Minister, Cameron,
which
getting
I
in on the act.
That might have been the photobomb element of it, Cameron.
Well, that was a double selfie, but the reason we all knew about it was because there was that great picture of Michelle Obama looking really angry, which was great. But, of course, when you saw the next picture in that set, she was absolutely fine with it. Which just shows you can make a picture do anything.
She was trying to get in as well.
I thought that was great. I mean, you have to, don't you? I mean, yeah. I was at something I can't talk about last night.
It's kind of a funeral.
It wasn't a funeral, though.
Oh, well,
if you're around the grave, that's fine. But this was a football stadium where people were sort of booing the Prime Minister. I thought that was great. It was fantastic. The best thing was the guy doing the signing. Every day it gets worse.
Know.
It started off, he couldn't do it. Then he was schizophrenic. I think yesterday he announced he'd
killed... Society had a go at him.
But yesterday he announced he'd killed a man with a burning tyre and stuff. I mean, by the end, it's going to be, he ran apartheid. It's fantastic.
What's sign language for I killed a man with a burning tyre?
I think it's...
It's pretty decent. So for this new trio of videos you've done for Bing,
a web series for Bing, yeah, and it's basically trigger happy esque, where I go out and do my usual thing of annoying the public, but mostly it's phone based. And actually, I love doing that because I do love what you can do with a phone now. I love photography, but I've finally given up on my lovely Leica. I just thought it's crazy to carry a camera and a phone when the phone is almost good enough. So I did a whole series where we were trying to sort of reinvent the selfie, because people do, that's the problem. Even when you do a great selfie, like that one with Cameron and Obama, it's brilliant, but you kind of want to do it a bit different. They're always the same. It's always people doing that, suck the cheekbones in sort of thing. So I was just playing with that. And because I used to think in the old days, when you thought video phones would come in, that was really going to screw you up with the ringing in sick at work.
Yeah.
You know, before you just had to put on a bad voice. And I thought it's going to come a place where you have to put a false background and sort of office noise or whatever. And I think that's what people should do with selfies. You should be able to kind of drop them onto, so you can pretend that you're having a great holiday.
Yeah.
Because that's one of the things on Facebook, isn't it? People have Facebook envy. No one ever puts up.
It's one of the things that was invented by, I know. It's always the humble brag, isn't it?
Humble brag is my favourite thing in the entire world. It's superb.
Oh, here I go. Oh, God.
But it's true, though, isn't it?
It's so boring to be getting up at 6 o'clock to fly to Hong Kong. At least it's business class.
It is.
You're like, oh.
Yeah, it is like, oh, God. Yeah. Who'd have thought little old me 10 years ago would now be president of the United States?
Little old United States of America.
Actually, that's what I'd love. I'd love the dullest Facebook ever, where it's just depressing stuff, but not even... humble, not like, oh, I'm really bored, but at least I'm going to a party tonight. It's just
but
like...
then I do like it when people put up a picture in irony, like, oh, I'm in seat 974D.
Yes,
in between somebody, and
you
here's,
see, that's
and here's
on
my
so
meal.
So many levels, isn't it? They're basically saying they know their plane so well, it's great. Yeah. I have to take two photos everywhere I go, because when I travel abroad, my wife is a very patient woman, but she does get annoyed because I'm going to nice places. So I always wait for the rainiest, horriblest, grimmest day, and then I take a picture to show her.
Yeah.
And I'll find the worst room and pretend it was my hotel room, but I'm not going to put that up on Facebook. So then I take the only time the sun came out, and if there's anyone famous. So two lives I have, totally.
We mentioned, Rob, in the introduction that Trigger Happy TV went to 70 countries in the end.
Well, you know, I love it when you mention that, but all it shows is you've just read my Wikipedia page.
I want to know, is it because...
we can correct it now
without being mean, is it because it's in the Mr. Bean kind of world where it is kind of international, you don't have to understand any language?
Well, if you're going to be mean to me by saying my show sold to 70 countries, even if that was true, that's not mean, there's a lot worse.
Mr. Bean.
No, I know what you're saying. I used to, you know, when I grew up, I hated Benny Hill. It was awful. But I used to watch it in Lebanon, and they would have subtitles in French and Arabic.
Yeah.
And both subtitles were saying completely different things, but it would work. And Mr. Bean, I'm not a fan of, but it's the cleverest business idea in the world, because A, he is a genius, and also that thing shows everywhere. I was in North Korea, and they were showing Mr. Bean. I mean, it's insane. They had Mr. Bean and Piers Morgan on. That's can you imagine those two extremes of Western... That keeps them in the country.
Really canvassing for a new president.
But it is weird, because actually when we did Trigger Happy, we didn't intentionally try and make something that would work.
Is that one of those humble brags? I was in North Korea the other day. Oh.
It's the two things I'll drop in every interview if you don't bring it up. It's I've been in North Korea, it's my travel brag. And then if you don't...
Yeah.
It's the first time I've been introduced without someone saying I went to school, the Osama bin Laden, so I'll drop that in now.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that on the Wikipedia?
Of course, it's all on there.
Yeah.
But I did genuinely used to put things up. If I was doing a round of interviews, I'd put a really stonker of a lie on, which you couldn't resist. But some of them stayed on. And I did sell Trigger Happy to a lot of countries. I have no idea how many. And I've changed the number. But it was definitely over 50.
But I see you're keeping very quiet on the fact that you were born with a tail.
Well, I think that's pretty obvious, isn't it?
I wanted to go back to Fubbing's my favourite of the three things.
Too.
I think Fubbing is something that's happened to everybody.
But also, fubbed.
Okay.
Because Fubbing is obviously just being rude to someone when they're trying to ask you.
Yeah.
And what we did, I spotted people, those people that walk, which only really happens in Britain. You go to America, people don't, on general, walk down the street on the phone, like not wanting to be alone.
Yeah.
We have so many people. So I'd wait for someone walking down, stop them. And they'd always do that. I'm on the phone too. And I'd insist till they stopped and go, I need to speak to you. So finally, they put the phone down and then mine would ring and then I'd make them wait. So it was a double hold.
It's good. But it is the worst thing. And it presumably is. You're tapping into what is a pet hate of people that don't realise is the phone must take precedence over everybody and everything in sort of contemporary life, right?
But it sort of has. I mean, the irony is I'm famous for my big mobile, which, you know, supposedly is a genius idea, but I had no idea I was doing anything good. Whereas now when I try and tap into new phone cultures, no idea at all, and it won't go anywhere. But it is weird, and it is particularly British, that phone, the fact that we're always on the phone. There is a sort of fear of, I don't know, if it's being alone or sitting on your own.
But in the US, is it? Do you think it's different in the US because people are on the hands-free? They've got the which is even more annoying thing. They've got the headphones in. They're talking to the little notch in the headphones.
Well, that's
it's a nutter thing. Yeah.
No, there's a certain type of person probably listening to this. The business person. There's a sort of global businessman who's always in Frankfurt airport, and they all have that thing because they're too busy because they're doing something else with their hands. But genuinely, if you look on an American street, I mean, firstly, there aren't many people walking around in America because if you walk, you're either a criminal or you're homeless.
Yeah,
everyone drives. But they don't do it. The only place is near the Mexican border. They have this weird sort of mobile, which is like a walkie-talkie, and so you don't pay the normal rates. So Mexicans talk incredibly loudly into stuff. And in India, they don't talk, but they use their mobiles like a sort of ghetto blaster. So as you're walking down the street, you'll be watching some awful Bollywood movie sort of thing. Yeah. Everyone has their own bits, you know.
It's like being on a bus in Hackney.
I don't know. I've no idea. I've never had that pleasure.
But it's amazing how many you see young people walking down the street who obviously they've grown a kind of an ability to kind of not look where they're going, but not bump into anyone. That's quite clever.
Well, that's almost
that's because
radar.
Everyone else is getting out of their way.
Well, no, I presume they have the new Google app, which is called Bat App or whatever, which kind of radars you around people. I mean, when I did the big mobile thing, you know, it was not thought through. But the main premise, if you look back at it, is why are you shouting? I mean, there is a microphone. You don't need to. And so it was either that or they were just showing off. They wanted people to know what they're doing. And we've all been on the train where some guy is just treating it like an office and telling you the most boring thing about some meeting he doesn't have to have.
Yeah.
But people still do that. And I occasionally just go up to them and just go, shh, and they're just like, ugh.
Yeah. There is that thing. It's the thing. It's sort of lots of pubs obviously ban the mobile phone.
Have they?
Yeah. Lots of pubs in London won't have you have to go outside if you want to use a mobile phone. I mean, there's a reason for that because there's something nauseating about someone that's talking about something. It's only the boring sort of things. My friend used to talk about this. There was someone in her office who used to describe to his mother, and this is the lack of boastfulness, but he thought it was boastfulness. But he still lived with his mum, and he would describe how he wanted his dinner cooked. And
it was
one word answers: baked. And stuff. I mean, I presume he's talking about
this. But what annoys me is that I have to be banned from using my mobile somewhere when of all people, trust me, when my phone goes off, people are just waiting.
That must be a horrible moment, though.
Well, it's half me thinks, should I be ironic and have that tone and just shout? But of course, I'm even more, so I'm really.
Hi.
So that, yeah, but that is what it is, and I can't talk. And that's fine. Why should I pay for the idiots that do insist on telling everything about them? And I've never heard anyone doing that loud talk with anything interesting. They're having an argument with their wife or...
I buried her under the patio.
No, but that's what you want, isn't it? It's great. You never have that. They're the only discreet ones.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'm just going to kill myself if you carry on like that.
Exactly.
That was the comedian Dom Jolly there speaking to us here in the studio. Thanks for coming in, Dom.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
Once upon a time, it was seen with disdain, but over the years, that culture had gotten so popular, it's iconic now.
If you're serving decent food in East London, I don't think you've got any problem getting custom in. And I worked in the West End for years, you know. I mean, it's not always packed in the West End, trust me.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
That's The Menu. Every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
Do you fancy a Christmas record, Andrew?
I'd love a Christmas record, please, Rob.
I think we're going to have something. It's on the Monocle playlist. It's one of my favourite recording artists, Leona Lewis.
Okay.
I'm not joking. It's not one of my favourite recording artists. But One More Sleep is a great sentiment. It's a sort of childish sentiment, but it's also a romantic sentiment, isn't it?
And oddly, I heard this track the other day.
Yeah.
It's not a bad Christmas song.
It's a nice Christmas song. I've been listening to it on other competing radio stations, but clearly it's presented the best when we do it ourselves. This is Leona Lewis with her Christmas track, One More Sleep. Leona?
I love Leona.
You should see the video. That was Leona Lewis with One More Sleep. And welcome back to this holiday edition of the Monocle Weekly. Now, I think it's safe to say that we all know how exhausting the Christmas period can be. Our social lives tend to be stacked to the brim with dinners and, of course, lots and lots of booze, whether it's rum-spiced eggnog or the cinnamon flavours of mulled wine. Well, it's time for us now to turn to perhaps a little less unknown Christmas drink, gin. I mean, there's plenty of it in my house, Andrew.
Can you have a less unknown?
I don't know. It's like a Donald Rumsfeldism, yeah, isn't it?
I don't think
it's
you can
a
have
known unknown.
A less unknown means it's very known, I think. Anyway, Simon Gamble and his father Mark run a small family distillery using a hand-built copper still to create the flavours and recipes for their gin. The brand, called Two Birds Spirits, is only 6 months old, but they've had some big-name support, with Fortnum & Mason's naming their gin as Spirit for the month of December. We're delighted to say that Simon is here in the studio, armed with some gin. Let the taste testing begin.
Hi, guys.
A rhyming couplet.
Yeah, I'm a poet as well. Simon, let's be honest, lots of people coming into the market with gin. Why is it the moment for this huge gin competition? We had a story going in the magazine, and I think next month, about Belgium, and they're really annoyed because they kind of created all these Jennifers, and they're feeling that we've stolen a march in London with all these gins taking off. Why is it gin's moment?
It's a very difficult question to answer.
Because there's money to be made from some...
Well, yeah, the market's always growing.
It's very Moorish, isn't it?
Although I think gin still accounts for a small percentage of the actual spirits industry. But in the last couple of years, I think the government have made it a bit easier for sort of home distilleries. So it's people to start up their own companies and start their own distilleries. It's a little bit easier
for
the
government. That's interesting. Yeah, they've
in the last couple of years, they've not relaxed laws. It's still quite difficult to get... You still have to go through a lot of hoops, and there's the HMRC and duty paid, and getting the premises set up and licensed and all that. So there's still quite a lot to go through. It's quite a lengthy process.
Is the basic business of making gin quite simple? Because you know, you think back to Victorian times, and it was always the thing that people tried to make at home.
Yeah,
is it actually? You know, I'm sure that yours is. Involves a lot more experience and subtlety. But is actually the very basic thing about making gin actually not that complicated?
Well, it's essentially starting. I think as well, the interesting thing is it comes from vodka. It's just a flavoured vodka. Gin is essentially just juniper flavoured vodka. So I think if you just wanted to set out and make spirit, sort of vodka would be slightly boring to start with, you know, it's sort of odourless, flavourless. Yeah. So I think the progression is then the gin, and there's a big drive of slow gin, sort of, you know, the sort of wintertime countryside as well. People love sort of slow gins, and that obviously is a derivative of straightforward gin. So I think it's slightly more interesting spirit to start making, and it's so complex as well. To be a gin, you just have to be juniper flavoured vodka, but nowadays people are mixing up to 40 botanicals. So the breadth of gin, although traditionally ours is classed as a traditional style London gin, so it's very juniper led, but a lot of people are using licorice and all sorts of other botanicals to flavour it, so you actually get quite a variety of taste. So it's quite an interesting product to be able to play around with, and lots of different flavours. You know, one distillery in Cambridgeshire is actually bespoking their each gin for each customer. So they don't have their own flavour. They actually tailor every flavour they make.
Bounds
for
number one,
so,
yes.
So there's
bound and tucked.
There's lots of great new distilleries opening up, doing lots of different things. So, you know, although it's quite a large market now.
Background, your dad Mark's background, that you suddenly felt you should start doing this?
Well, apart from we've loved gin in our family for a very long time. It's one of the first drinks I actually remember drinking.
Age three.
Not far off. there's always a bottle of Gordon's hanging around in the drinks cabinet. So my dad's background, he's an engineer. He's had a family business of catering equipment. He designed and built sort of commercial catering fridges, ovens and temperature controlled devices, things like that. And so he's always had a hankering for building stuff. And so he set about building our own copper still. So it was quite individual in that way. I think there's a couple of small distilleries that build their own, but certainly not that we know of in our respect with a copper still. And it's bespoke to exactly how we like to make our gin. And because gin is a slightly more interesting drink to make out of a still, you know, we started to produce it. We produced a gin that our family in particular loved drinking, and before we knew it, more and more people were like, this is...
So let me ask you how it works. You sort of, do you start off with something quite basic? You said there's always a bottle of Gordon's in the drinks cabinet when you were a kid and all the rest of it. I guess that's, you know, that's kind of the standard, isn't it? The sort of British standard. How do you decide what you like? Do you taste all the other branded gins? Do you mix them with different things? How do you know what you want to put into the one that you finally end up making yourself?
Well, I mean, for a long time, there was Gordon's, Bombay, and Tanqueray were sort of main for many years, and they're quite diverse in their flavourings and tastes. So it wasn't until in the last couple of years actually get such a variety. I think the award we won this year was for the craft distillers, and they said that until this year they wouldn't have been able to hold these awards. There weren't enough craft artisan distilleries, you know, with a variety of drinks to be able to do something like this. So I think there were 20 registered this year now. And we were up against 18.
And when they taste them, do they taste them neat or do they taste them with tonic? They taste them neat.
Three rounds. There was smell, aroma, then there was tasted neat, and then there was also then tasted with Fever Tree, which is what I've brought.
Let's mix them up.
Let's talk
Simon.
Bound.
Well, let's...
More drink.
I was trying to bust in for quite a long time. Simon, Jesus Christ. Comes in, doesn't he? But where is it?
Well, would you like to try and neat first? Do you want to?
Yeah.
Well, let's do it.
I think it's interesting.
Let's do it neat first.
Yeah, I think you'll find it quite interesting.
We could interview you about moustaches as well. You've got a very fine moustache there. You've got like one of those Victorian moustaches you could twiddle at the ends.
Yes, I do spend a lot of time giving it a little bit.
He was good, didn't he?
Yes.
It's very good. You'll hate me for saying this, Simon, but I'm willing to be disputed heavily on this point and on the radio, but I always kind of felt like it was the tonic that made a lot of difference. I'm a Gordon's man, you know. I sort of think that as long as it's mixed with as long as you get the mixing right and it's got the right amount of lime and it's the right sort of coldness.
Yes, but if you want to enjoy a gin, then the tonic shouldn't overpower the gin. Otherwise, you might as well just drink
a
large
strong
tonic.
Smell.
Yeah. Well, I think it's good to try this neat. Is that your preconceptions of perhaps getting those little alcohol burns at the back of the throat?
Things peppery.
Like, it's gone because it's so smooth. You just actually get a whole hit of juniper. Earthy flavours, tastes in there.
It's still a little burning in a nice way.
But you haven't had lunch before this, so.
It is 40%. You know, you have to drink 40%. But it's still drinkable. And I, you know, from the tastings in the last few days at Fortnum's, I've met a few people that say they like to have it large ice cube, a couple of shots, and drink it very slowly and let the ice melting and just drink.
And is this? I wonder if this is a way that you're trying to. Maybe you guys are trying to reintroduce gin drinking, because as you say, we mentioned Belgium and Holland. Obviously, I guess it came from Holland. It came from the Flemish countries.
Geneva.
That's where it sort of comes from. It was picked up, but it was a Dutch export to England, wasn't it?
It was.
Hence
yes.
Hogarth Gin Lane and all the rest of it.
Well, yeah, it was. I think not very well controlled in the early days, and so they wanted to stop people going
enough.
Out. Yeah,
in England, people have the idea it's mother's ruin, but they also have this idea that gin makes you a bit depressed. Is that true?
Perhaps if you drink a bad one.
Yeah, but there's no truth in that at all.
No, not that I've experienced.
But it's just depressed people drink gin.
Yeah, perhaps.
Now, how come you managed after 6 months to kind of, you know, knock down the very fine doors of Fortnum & Mason's and find yourself as the toast of the town?
It's been quite an interesting last 6 months, really.
Are we going to have some tonic, by the way?
That, by the way, that is delicious.
It is very, very, very nice. Let's have some more.
Yeah.
No problem.
Have we got any ice in there?
I did ask, but they said they couldn't get hold of any ice, but I've...
Christ.
how strong do you like it? Do you like...
Well, I think we probably want to be able to taste it, don't you, Andy?
Yes. Yep. You are speaking to a gentleman, not me, him, who on a Friday night when we used to complete the issues, he would sneak out, he would buy those ones ready-made in a can.
Yeah, but for the office. For the office, for everyone. No, but I also did. I also used to go to the off-licensee old office and get the whole
works. And you would return with the lemons and everything.
And I'd have everything, the limes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That bad. But the Marks & Spencer's ones, which I notice now have toned down their alcohol content. This is our creative director, Richard Spencer-Powell, favours this on a Friday.
Okay, try this. It's a bit hard without a measurer, but hopefully the balance in there is quite good.
And so there's a drop of tonic in there as well.
There's a drop of tonic, yeah.
Cheers, thank you.
It's been an interesting 6 months. So everything we've sort of experienced over the last few months has been very organic.
That's lovely.
We won our first award before we'd even sold a bottle. And from that, we've got into a few bars in London that picked up on it because of the awards. There's the Star in Soho, so they run the London Gin Club.
Yeah.
They've had it since August.
I was going to ask you, because actually there's this whole revival of these kind of like these cocktail bars that are kind of trying to, you know, throw themselves back to the 30s almost. Is that also helped the kind of revival of gin?
Yeah, I think they've kind of gone hand in hand, really. I think, you know, each is sort of jumping on the back of the other. They've realised that there's...
I like all those drinking metaphors, holding hands, jumping on the backs of each other. That's what happens after a few.
Licking each other's faces. That's what he means.
They've helped each other a lot.
Yeah, I think they have. I think, you know, it's, certainly this year has been a really big year. I mean, we were in development for quite a while. And in that time, you know, we were always monitoring the market and seeing who else was releasing gins. And I think since we've released ours, there's a new one every month popping up. You know,
yeah, there's a lot of chat about gin.
Yeah, and as I say, it comes from the variety you can make. You know, people are experimenting so much. I mean, Sacred Gin produced a number of varieties of gins. You know, we've got our London Dry Gin, and we also produce vodka. We also produce an absinthe.
Right.
And then we also do seasonal spirits. So we go out and collect sloes from the hedgerows or damsons. We grow raspberries in our allotments and things like that. So you know, we've got quite a variety of products.
And I was just going to ask about the different varieties of gin, because there's London gin, there's like Plymouth gin, there's Navy gin. How different are they? What they flavoured with?
Well, a London dry gin is a style of gin.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We're a London dry gin. We don't have to be made in London. It's not really.
It's not like champagne.
No. It's the I think the might get caught out on this, but the to be called
a
London dry
to London?
Gin.
Have you? No? We could do it, can we, Andrew? We've been, haven't we?
You don't have to, you're not allowed to use artificial sweeteners and flavourings, and I think the process in which it goes through the still is monitored. Otherwise, you could go and buy a vat of vodka and throw some junipers in, and that's gin. You know, and you don't need any...
I wonder what the difference between like Plymouth gin and London gin is, for example. Is there something in the way it's made, the way it's distilled, or the flavourings that are put in there? Or...
Yeah, the Plymouth gin, I think came...
I quite like a Plymouth gin.
Yeah, that because it's on the ports, that was one of the first distilleries, I think, when the navies used to go out. And I think that gin predominantly was for the officers and the rum was for the sailors and the merchant guys.
Now, we heard earlier on where the name Spearmint Rhino comes from. Where does two birds come from? It wasn't inspired when you were in Spearmint Rhino, was it?
No, I know. Well, funnily enough, there's actually a...
Very good question.
He says, twiddling his moustache. Wow.
No, we put a lot of thought into the name and the branding. We produced quite a few different drinks. We didn't want to be set to as just a gin company, and we didn't want to follow the route of other companies that brand them with their own names and sort of go down that route. So we wanted something that reflected the product, where the product comes from, what the product is about, and something that could transfer across all the other products we did.
So the absinthe is, you know, two birds absinthe.
Yep, it's all under the two birds. And what we do is the bottles, we produce these are the screens to print, have to be put on by hand, so they're all organic inks as well. And the birds change colour depending on the spirit. So the absinthe, they're lime green. The vodka, they're black. The sloe gin, they're purple. So they start to take on a little life of their own. They've become this little product of ours that we quite like.
We like it as well.
Two birds better than one, Andrew.
Yes. Well, yes, exactly. Gin and tonic, two birds, vodka, lemonade, everything. Absinthe and water. Everything is best enjoyed in pairs, either.
That's not what
with
I meant.
Somebody else.
That's not what I meant. Simon Gamble from Two Birds Gin and Vodka and Slow Gin, etc., etc. Thank you for talking us through it. And by the way, do we need a top-up?
Do you need
Andrew?
A top-up?
Yeah, we should have a top-up before the next guest. Yeah. Why not?
But thank you so much for joining us.
No, thanks for having us, guys.
Up next, we'll find out more about the trends in Christmas parties and what it takes to pull in the crowds.
Each week, Section D takes a thorough look at the design world. From fashion to furniture, from lighting to tasteful living, we'll bring you the most interesting news from design studios across the globe.
Where is society going? What is the furniture that will lead what society will want in terms of furniture functions and forms?
We see that more and more contemporary designers actually do not think about the mass-produced object. That's not what drives them. That's not what they're interested in. That's not what they think they want to contribute to this world.
It's not just making clothes, but shoes and accessories and thinking about the character or the narrative of the collection.
Join me, Tom Morris, on Section D, your one-stop guide to the world of design.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Lexus.
And welcome back to the show. We're fast approaching the end of the weekly, but we've still got time to celebrate the Christmas period in some style. We're delighted to say that we're joined here in the studio by Andrea Sterling from B&H Group. It's the company that's behind some of the most well-known events around the world. Party-tastic ones like the Blitz Party to the annual Windstock held each year here in the UK.
Well, to talk things all party-related and some of the trends when it comes to Christmas and New Year, it's time now to turn to Andrea. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly. So we were just chatting before we came on air that you have some 5,500 people to entertain on New Year's night with themed parties from Prohibition to the Blitz. Just tell us, first of all, how that all kind of works on the night. Are you running between all these different events? Are you kind of fretting about DJs and doormen and, you know, the security?
Hopefully not by this time. We've done New Year's Eve for 4 years, 5 years now. So perhaps that was the case with the first ever party we did on New Year's Eve. But by this time, hopefully we've got everything booked and sorted in advance.
And not being stupid, what makes a good event? You know, is it finding a new venue at each time?
It's inviting you, Andrew.
Okay, I'll come. I presume you're stone cold sober watching these events go on. You're not quite in the mood of all the people there on the dance floor enjoying themselves. When you survey things, do you know that people are having a good time? Can you see all the elements coming together? What adds that kind of special element to a party?
I mean, 100%. I think that the most important thing is that people trust us not to screw up their New Year's Eve, so we can't screw it up.
That's so, actually pressure.
Well, it is a lot of pressure, actually. Yeah. But, you know, we've built that trust with our database by this point. So it's all about planning. We need to make sure that every single party is 10 times better than it's ever been before. We need to make sure that there is 10 times more entertainment. We need to make sure that the cocktails are amazing, that people are really getting value for money and that they're really enjoying themselves. And I think largely we manage, but that is mainly down to planning.
And there's a thing with planning is an interesting answer, and it's not an unexpected answer, but everyone has the idea that a great party is all about serendipity. You know, they might meet someone amazing at a party, or all the cocktails might be amazing, or they might see some amazing band or some amazing performer at a party. They feel that the idea presumably is to do all that planning, but make it feel like it's happened by accident.
Of course, right? That's the magic of it. I mean, if someone has a bad night, they don't necessarily know why. They're just not in the mood. And that might be a mixture of things. It might be that lighting isn't quite right. It might be that it's too hot or it's too cold in the venue. It might be that the music levels are just slightly too loud too early on. And those are things that normally when you're in a bar, when you're at a party, you're not necessarily aware of it. You just know that something's not right. It's our job to know exactly.
So you have
what
a
that combination
party
of things
sense, then is this
and how, yeah, we're really magicians
from,
you know.
But it is there's an art and a science, and there's a sixth sense to this kind of thing of getting the vibe. Do you presumably do a lot of research, or do you just do it off your own back and you kind of test it out yourself, or you just sort of hope it goes all right on the night? How do you put together something that's kind of never been done before, which is some of these parties you're doing for New Year's
Well
Eve?
I mean, you know, we're running parties at least 3 months throughout the year, different themes, different crowds. And so you learn as you go.
Yeah.
And, you know, you might try something new for one party and then you think, oh, goodness, that really didn't particularly work. But those real kind of fundamentals, which is what creates a brilliant atmosphere, which might seem something intangible, is actually completely scientific. And it's something that you learn very quickly, because if you don't learn it, you don't have a successful party brand.
Now, lots of people come to your parties, you know, they want to be dressing up, they want to be, it's, you know, it's the 1940s, it's the 1930s. Is that part of, you know, why has that happened? Because, you know, I guess, you know, 10 years ago, everyone was out in jeans and T-shirts and it was like house music and that was enough for everybody. Why is this kind of resurgence of kind of dressing up and wanting these kind of big themed events?
I think that, you know, since everyone has sort of, you know, over the past few years had to tighten their belts a little bit and really had to start kind of watching how much they're spending, they have become much more discerning and they want much more than £20 to get into a really boring nightclub on a Saturday night. They actually want value for money, and that's what we give them. They want something where they're not treated as imbeciles who pay £20 to get absolutely nothing original. They want something where they can really have an invested part in their night, where they can really use their imagination and be part of the reason that whole entire party is so exciting. And that's why I think dress-up events, particularly themes like the Blitz Party and the Prohibition Party, have been so successful. You know, the girls will book their tickets 6 weeks in advance. They'll get their hair done properly. They'll get their makeup done properly. They'll spend three different weekends on Portobello Road trying to find the right outfit. And so it means that the entire evening is actually a huge experience. And it means that on the night, because people have invested so much into their evening, they will have a brilliant time. They will enter into the spirit of it so much more. And you will find that our parties, I don't think you'll come across a friendlier, happier crowd in London. They're so happy to be there and they've put so much into their night that they're ready to kind of really make the most of it and have a good time.
That's an interesting idea. I like the idea of that. That you may be right. It is about sort of belt tightening and people kind of want to invest in their own evening knowing that it'll make it more fun. But there's also a point, I wonder what you think about this, the fact that maybe there's not a, in terms of music maybe, or the vibe, Andrew's talking about house music and everyone was like T-shirts and jeans a few years back. There's no kind of genre that bestrides the century you're in, the decade we're in at the moment. So everyone can take a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of the other, and make their own kind of thing. It's not like we're in a house culture or a dance culture or a punk culture right now.
I suppose. And also, I think to a certain extent, people got quite bored of not having to put any effort into how they looked. There's, you know, you ask any girl, she wants to dress up and look glamorous. And actually, we find it with the men as well that once they start having to wear a dinner jacket, they never get the opportunity to do that. And so there is something to be said, I think, with being able to look really glamorous and then it reflects on your mood as well.
And I was going to ask if it's easier to get people to sort of behave when they're dressing up.
100%.
Yeah, because people kind of, there's bad behaviour and there's bad behaviour, you know.
The men actually hold doors open,
Andrew's,
and the girls
Andrew's
accept
looking at
it.
Us both.
And there's our Christmas party. It's but it's a fact, right?
100%.
Dressed up, you don't want to. Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're always going to, if you're dressed in a way that makes you feel sort of slightly more kind of like you look glamorous, you're going to behave. Your behaviour is going to reflect that. You will hold the door open for a lady, and not only that, a lady, even a London lady, will actually accept that and say thank you rather than it's okay, I can do it myself.
Even a London lady, Andrew.
we've talked enough about London ladies this afternoon. Now tell me, how did you get into this world? What was your kind of entry point as a party goer or as a...
I fell in by pure good luck, really. I just happened to know some people who were participating in these nights. I originally worked at a bar in Fitzrovia called Bourne and Hollingsworth, which is where the first Prohibition Party was ever put on. And purely by chance, because the manager at that bar had had someone call in sick, I ended up working at the very first Prohibition. And so purely by chance, I just kind of got thrown into it and I loved it. And, you know, I kind of understood it right from the beginning. So, yeah, it was just
and
a chance.
Of all the kind of themed events that you do, is there one that for you that's your kind of natural territory?
I've gone through phases with all of them, but I have to say the one that at the moment, at least, I love the most is the Dark Circus Party. And I think it's because it's a slightly newer brand. It's quite risque. It really demands a lot of imagination and creativity.
And this kind of taps into the burlesque world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it goes even further than that. It's a real kind of circus theme. It's run by both Bourne and Hollingsworth and Torture Garden. So it's also that tiny bit of sort of danger that you might not find at most parties.
Do you have a very big wardrobe?
I used to, and then I threw it all out, so now I really struggle.
I thought you were going to ask if it said S&M in the back of her knickers rather than M&S. That's something I obviously wouldn't be able to ask that question.
No comment.
I'm just having some gin.
But you do have a kind of few circus outfits in.
Definitely. I've got to have a few staples for every single party, unfortunately. So rather than normal clothes, I've got quite a lot of 20s and 40s and corsety type things.
What's the deal with the retro thing? Because I mean, obviously, all the stuff, all the Prohibition, then the Blitz Party, all the stuff we've referenced, kind of is going back to the future, isn't it?
It kind of fits in with the gin story as well. He was talking about the fact that all these Prohibition bars are coming back. There's something about that era that people really like at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to look at Boardwalk Empire, Gatsby the movie. I mean, the Prohibition, sort of the speakeasy style bars have been going for about 7 or 8 years now. You know, and it just keeps on coming back. You had, I think it was Prada who ran a 20s campaign two seasons ago. Yeah. You've had Boardwalk Empire, which has been really, really popular. Then you've had Gatsby, which has just brought it right back again. And people can't really get enough of it. You've got all the clothes in the high street. It's that idea of glamour, I think, and really not kind of...
And sort of a guiltless way of partying as
That's
well.
That's the thing. You don't have any rules and you don't have any guilt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how do you feel? That's how I feel, Andrew.
No rules, no guilt. You've got the T-shirt, haven't you?
I wouldn't wear it to one of her parties.
Okay.
I mean, come on. You know, they've got standards. They've got standards at B&H.
And so on New Year's Eve, you're going to be at all of these events, then?
I don't think I personally will. I think that I will stick to one party.
Because otherwise, that's a lot of costume changes.
Well, yeah, and also it's just quite a lot of distance to cover because unfortunately they're not all next door to each other.
And we should talk. Oh, actually, we should ask about the venues because clearly these are fantastically important to the success of the evening, as well as the music and the lighting and the cocktails and all the rest of it. Where are they going to be at?
So the Prohibition Party, we've released the venue today, and that is the Bloomsbury Ballroom, which is really beautiful Holborn. Absolutely amazing Art Deco ballroom. And then the Dark Circus Party is a really cool venue opposite King's Cross called the Grand Hall St Pancras. And then the Blitz Party is...
Is that the German Gymnasium? Is that the same?
No, okay. I don't think so.
Sounds like it could be a bit S&M, doesn't it? But it's not.
And then, Blitz is in this huge, this gigantic old railway arch in London Bridge, which lends itself magnificently to a Blitz party.
And that's the exciting thing about what you do as well, it's finding all these places.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Because I think when you go to an event like that, that's the excitement. Rob's thinking of other things. But that's exactly the thing.
I'm thinking of that place on Portland Square where that woman was chained to the radiator. So.
Yeah, we heard a funny story about a house on a...
Everyone knows it.
It was in the newspapers. Yeah. And apparently the gentleman told us he went to have a look around for an event like the day after one of these kind of like sex parties. They'd forgotten a lady who was kind of
still chained to the radiator.
She was sitting there naked when they entered the room to kind of look and see if it was a nice place to hold an art party.
Well, good to see you again, Andrea. I'm only joking, come on. They won't use that.
No. Well, Andrea, thank you very much for coming to see us and good luck on New Year's night. An amazing business, and it's great to see you doing so well in London.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's time for us to do our Christmas wrapping, Andrew.
I think they're going to have to call a taxi for Bound and Tucked.
Would you go to a club or a night at a club called Bound and Tucked? What do you think that would mean?
I think it sounds a bit kind of Torch Garden to me.
Oh,
it all went horribly wrong. I got Bound and Tucked.
That's probably what our guests thought today. What's that happens when you go out for lunch and then you have a gin person coming in as your second guest? And then
Dom Jolly, who kind of like... He was badly behaved. Oh, that gentleman he was.
He's rather good, actually. I'm glad he kind of souped it up a bit. Because, it was sort of... It had a turbocharged opening.
I like
salvo,
the fact that he just
it?
Literally didn't know where he was either.
No, he thought... I like the thing he was like, well, they've told me to come in. It's a business show, is it? But I like what he said about that, thinking that what he said was about business. He's like, oh, yeah, I've been primed by my PR. I'll just talk about business. It's like, in what sense? You don't know anything about business, which I quite like.
He was good. He was slightly worried when he left the room, realising he hadn't done the job that he was meant to do.
But that's even better, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's right.
Dom Jolly, we like you.
I do like him.
He can come back.
And if no one has seen Two Tickets for Upper Circle, you can look at it on any of the website search engines available, presumably, including Google and Bing.
I think so. Yeah. Well, it says here that today's show was... produced by Phil Hahn.
Well, I haven't seen him, so let's not say thanks to him.
So should we thank Isabel Kaiser instead?
Isabel Kaiser's there. Isn't she lovely behind the glass? Jack Phillips is there as ever.
Yes, he's got a loll at the end of these shows, isn't he? Have you noticed? It's not good for his back. He doesn't sit up.
No, he doesn't. I don't know how he can sit. How he can even reach the microphone. It looks like a small child with a beard.
And he hasn't had the gin yet.
No.
This was episode 234, and it was a very special Christmas edition of the Monocle Weekly. Yeah. We got that line out nicely as well, and
I think it takes now is for me, Robert Bound,
and me, Andrew Tuck,
to say thanks for tuning in and Merry Christmas.
Cheers, Rob.
Chin chin.